freedom and or bread, I think is the way Dale put it on the board. The title I gave to you, Dale, right? The reason for this discussion comes from a forum we had last week on China, in which Walt Bowman and Al and Carol talked about the meaning of China to our society. That's one of my interpretations anyway. And one of the questions that was raised was in terms of what price freedom, you might say. Again, this is my interpretation. It seems to me that Americans, we, myself, when we think of freedom, we prize it a great deal, whatever that means. And I think that's what we're going to try to get to today. And when we think that there's another society in which freedom, as perhaps we conceive of it, or imagine it to be in our own culture, is not present, then we are very fearful of what happens in that society, and we don't, we either reject it or try to do away with it or something. And so we were talking about what is freedom, what does it mean to be a creative artist, you might say. I mean, could you be a creative artist in another society that limits you as an individual? So what we thought we would do today is try to sort of enlarge on this concept of freedom and really try to dig in to what it really means. And obviously, as you know, there are many, many interpretations of what freedom is, and we probably all have very different interpretations. The way we're going to try to get down to thinking about the very broad, rich concept of freedom is through the Russian writer Dostoevsky, whom I've had some exposure to this year and have found a great deal of substance about the idea of freedom in his works, and he confuses me a great deal. And so we'd like to share some of those ideas of Dostoevsky in order to get some basis for discussion. This is not a two-person situation. This is a group situation. So if in our introductory remarks or conversation you want to break in, fine, but then, you know, let's then move on out to the group, because that's where we really try to work together as a group. Now, in reading all the major novels of Dostoevsky in about 10 weeks this past year, that's quite a task. It was a most enjoyable task. I would say that one of the principal ingredients in his novels, which is freedom, is the concept of freedom. And believe me, this man struggles a great deal. I'd like to say a little something about Dostoevsky. In the 1840s, he was very much involved in French social thought. Now, the Russian intelligentsia were very much influenced by France, by the Western nations, and very much into what a good world could be, so to speak. And Dostoevsky was very much influenced by a man named Fourier, some other people in France, United States, that had some ideas of what a good world could look like, what a golden age could be. If only we could have this in the world, things would be better. Wanted an ideal world. And what could we do so it could be justice and there would be no suffering? He was very much involved in that. He was beginning to write his stories about and dealing with the nature of human beings and what it was like early in the 1840s. He was arrested because his group was too radical in the Tsarist Russia, and he was sent off to Siberia for 10 years. And he comes back, and he begins his major novel, starting with Notes from the Underground, ending with The Brothers Karamazov. Beginning with the Notes, he then really begins to question this idealism that he had. And all through his novels, he's very concerned that how can an individual express his freedom in a society that might just, that would not allow him to be free, you might say. I'd like to, a quote from the Notes from the Underground are, in his struggle, he says, "For what is man without desires, without free will, and without the power of choice, but a stop in an organ pipe?" He got really frightened that we would get so caught up in a harmonious society that we would be cogs in a machine. You've heard those statements before. And then how is the individual to be free? But as you go through his novels, and those of you who've read it know that all his free characters are very destructive characters, that man in his freedom is often very, very destructive. That just to be free does not necessarily mean that you will be good. And Dostoevsky continuously expounds on this topic, from Notes from the Underground, his character in Crime and Punishment, who goes out and kills a person that he thinks ought to be, that's a detriment to society, ought to die. This guy goes out and kills her, in his freedom. In The Possessed, you've got a freedom that's very much like a vacuum where one of the characters feels that because all is permitted, man can do whatever he wishes, in his freedom, that you can do a destructive act just as easily and without any problem with your conscience, just as easily as you can do a good act.
I think there are three notions of freedom functioning in what you've said thus far. And one notion is somehow that freedom is the freedom, it's license, it's the freedom to do as you please, without any limitation. And the other thing I think I see, and it's come out of our discussions of Dostoevsky, is the notion that people who are free from external restraints are really bound up by internal restraints, by compulsions. Most of Dostoevsky's characters, to me, are simply bound by compulsion, so that, from my point of view, they are not internally free. They might be free, they might be in a society which is not telling them what to do, but they are so determined by their personal history, by things that have happened to them, that their freedom to initiate whatever they might want to is very meaningless, because they can't escape their internal compulsion. So as I see it, you have three notions of freedom functioning. One is simply license to do as you please. It's freedom from external restraint. The other is an internal freedom, somehow being in control of yourself, so that you could follow your rational desire. Many of Dostoevsky's characters simply couldn't do what they wanted to, because they are bound to destroy themselves and other people. And third notion is that in your freedom, I think Dostoevsky asserts that to be free would be to be bound to God. That is, it would be to be bound by, it would be to choose limits, directions, a binding of oneself. I don't know whether that makes sense to you, whether I'm talking about the Dostoevsky you know or not.
No, I think that he would, he is so concerned in terms of what man does in his freedom and with his internal pressures. He was one of the first to do these real psychological studies, almost, in terms of what internally controls human nature or human behavior. What he doesn't present most of the time is what it would be like if a person in his freedom also had Christ in his freedom. He shows characters generally that are controlled by compulsions. And the tyranny of freedom is really what he deals with in his novels, I think. Now, somebody may disagree generally.
So it's really being bound by one's personal history is over against by some. I guess if I thought you were bound by Christ, I would think you would be bound by the meaning of your existence, or what you might call your essential self, is over against this compulsive self. by the image of God in you as over against by those things which have conditioned you. Well, we might go on to talk about Dostoevsky's notion of whether man really wants freedom or not.
The culmination, as many of you know, of Dostoevsky's idea of freedom is in The Grand Inquisitor, The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor. That's a section in The Brothers Karamazov. And of course, the legend has been lifted out of The Brothers Karamazov very often in terms of for us to be able to deal with the idea of man in his freedom or her freedom, woman in her freedom. Those of you that may not know The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, let me just sort of sketch it in a little bit. If I can do justice to it, I'll try. First of all, it's a poem, and it's told by Ivan Karamazov, one of the brothers. Ivan is an intellect. He has reason. He tries to understand the world. He says, I'll take you, God, but your world I can't accept. He's a cynic. He can't understand why there is suffering in the world, as Gordon pointed out this morning. Why isn't there justice? Why is there pain? Can't man make a world that has no suffering? God certainly has messed up. In The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, then, with Ivan, the intellect, the cynic, the man who dislikes suffering, then begins to talk to the Grand Inquisitor. Those of you know the Spanish Inquisition that went on killed many heretics of the church. The Grand Inquisitor is having these heretics burned. Christ comes in this poem into the midst of the burnings. The Grand Inquisitor immediately seizes him, takes him to a dungeon, and says, you're going to burn tomorrow. And he says, I don't want to hear from you, but I've got a lot of things to say I've had on my mind for 90 years about what you, Christ, have done to this world.
900 years.
No, the Grand Inquisitor's 90 years old.
Oh, 90 years old, yeah.
Right. All right. He confronts Christ, and he says, you're supposed to have loved humanity. And he said, but you couldn't have possibly loved humanity, because what you did, Christ, was to give them this burden of freedom. And man is weak and ignoble and cannot handle the burden of freedom. Now, he wants to be able to have freedom, but he can't do it. And you've made a mess of things, Christ, because you had this image of human nature. Now, says the Grand Inquisitor, I know better. I know the reality of human nature. Man is weak. He doesn't want to take risks. He can't take responsibilities for what freedom might mean. Therefore, he has laid freedom at our feet. Our feet meaning the Grand Inquisitor and, for Dostoevsky, the church. He's laid freedom at our feet. He thinks he has the illusion of freedom, but we now, the few of us that are strong enough to be able to take the burden of freedom, we now control everything. So in the Grand Inquisitor's world, he has told Christ, you had three temptations. This is where the bread comes in. Remember the three temptations? Feed, make the rocks into bread, and Christ said no. And the Grand Inquisitor says, you feed people first, then you ask of them virtue. You have to have bread. People don't want freedom, they want bread. And we should get into that notion, maybe what the bread means. People want to have somebody take care of them. And people want to be able to worship in a universal situation. In other words, to make sure that we all believe alike, what he called the universal ant heap. Now that notion comes up with China a great deal. You know, do we want harmony? Do we want happiness? And is that a price for freedom? Do men choose to give up freedom because we can't handle it? Isn't that what you're getting to?
Well, I think of this as what I call sociological freedom, that since freedom is so difficult to handle, and since it leads to such destructive things, partly because of the internal compulsions and partly because people really don't want to take the responsibility and do what's necessary if they were responsible. I mean, look what it would mean to be responsible for decisions with regard to our culture, the kinds of efforts and information and energy that would be necessary. Therefore, we have an elite. We call it technocrats, or we call it the aristocracy. We turn over our freedom, and we have an illusion in a way that we are doing some things, but we don't even have to have an illusion. We're glad to have people take on all those decisions if it doesn't interfere too much with our existence. And, this introduces the notion that to be free may simply be to have the choice of turning over the decisions to somebody else. That it is to have a kind of electoral election system in which you elect people and then turn over the decisions to them. So that really introduces another notion of free. We are free if we've decided, you know, the conditions for somebody else controlling us. But we really don't want to participate in all the decision making. But we do want to have a kind of control. As yet, I don't see how we are enlisting some vision. Now, I think what Mao's done in China is to provide what he calls a vision of what it means to be human. And that vision is located in an informing set of documents and of principles and of ideas and of symbols. And this is imposed upon a culture by the ruling elite. I think what Mao's done is to combine that with a real faith in the people. It's extraordinary. It's a mystical kind of belief that out of the people can come truth and wisdom. So what Mao insists in what he calls democratic centralism is that every direction that is taken by the elite is fed into the people. 42, for example, they required everybody who was participating at any level in the government or in decision-making and all the party students to study 2 hours a day in groups. 3 months, students 2 months, the party officials 3 months, and then to take examinations over 22 documents. And then, in other words, it was a tremendous input in the effort to create a common vision of what the good is and what a good society is. But they were all participating. Now, once all that participation and feedback has taken place, the elite will decide what should be done, and then you obey. But it's after that process. So it's a strange kind of combination that's taking place that includes, I think, the grand inquisitor, that is, people who have truth, who have insight, who have wisdom, who have character, and a process in which the people are almost required to participate. They participate much more than we do as a citizen group in the discussion of the direction of the society. And so that in many ways it's more democratic than our society if you ask how much do we participate as individuals, who participates really in the direction of our society, insofar as the state directs it, insofar as we have a central direction. Now, we have a lot more freedom because there's a lot of what goes on in our country which is simply doesn't get any direction. It functions on its own within a very broad context. Well, it seems to me that American doctrine of freedom assumes freedom from external influence. We do very little, actually, with the meaning of that freedom to initiate. That is, theoretically, we do very little. Actually, practically, we do a great deal because of all our counseling, trying to free people. All our counseling is an effort to free people to decide for themselves, is over against being decided for by the personal history, which has conditioned people in a certain way. So that's a tremendous push in the direction of saying people are not free if they're not free from their past history. They can't really absorb it. But we are afraid of visions and of bindings and the notion that to be free is to be bound. That's really un-American. And it seems to me that what the Christian says is that we are free if we're bound to Christ. And what a Christian society would say, well, you are free if in your being bound to Christ, you are bound to the reality that means. But we have not made that transition. And so we've got a kind of a contradiction between our faith is insisting that we are bound to something and our political system, which insists we are bound to nothing, really bound to nothing. Now, that's maybe opened up some questions, some responses, some alternative interpretations. I don't know where it takes us, but...
Well, a couple of things. One, to me, freedom means you have the power to do what you think you need to do. And to me, you can do that here. I don't know whether you can do that, let's say, in China. Secondly, I'm kind of...
Gene, who has the power? The individual has the power.
Yes, the individual. We have the power, whether it's economically or whatever, to do what we think we need to do here. Secondly, our political process, I'm not greatly involved in it, but it seems to me you can go to a precinct caucus and you can get resolutions passed that have to go through in our state different levels. And sooner or later, you can have input into the platform of one of our two major parties. And I think the other night, everyone indicated that they didn't have a great deal of insider knowledge into how the Chinese system works. But we can input. I think if we want to, we can.
So in theory, you're saying that our notion of freedom is the freedom to initiate. And the fact is that we have the freedom to initiate. There are two issues there. Whether, in fact, we have the freedom to initiate, and the other one is the theoretical question, whether that is an adequate notion of freedom or a full enough notion of freedom. I just want to make a distinction. Jacques Ellul in Political Illusion says the whole West, it's illusion that we have that kind of freedom you're talking about. So that, I mean, I'm just saying he says it. That doesn't make it true. So one is the question of fact as to whether we really do have the question, you know, the power to initiate. I always think of Vietnam. It took us a long time to get a hold of the power to control Vietnam. And there are all kinds of things that prevented the people from speaking and having their will expressed, but we finally did. I mean, the people really did get control of that situation.
There are a lot of people, and they all have different views. Difficult to generalize.
But I'm interested in what the group thinks about whether this is a Christian notion of freedom or an adequate notion of freedom, which focuses upon the power of self-initiation.
Roxy.
I always think of the initiative process. If you've got a couple hundred thou, you have that freedom. But that is something that we are not wiped off the face of the earth doing. It's a very powerful tool in the United States. If we so desire, we can initiate what we want. And, you know, and we soon find out in a hurry whether there's anybody else that agrees with us by that same process, too. But you've got to have a lot of money.
Well, we might pursue that. We're now discussing whether or not we have the power to initiate that factual question.
In the U.S., if you have private bills and private members' bills that can be presented in to your legislature?
Private bills. You mean citizens' bills?
Yeah.
Some states.
Normally, you have to have a legislative sponsor.
Yeah,
write a bill. Then you got to get it through.
That's one way. I'd like to know, after all these people have gone over these 20 principles, what was it, 20 books or 20 principles or 20
documents.
Documents. When you were mentioning that, it made me think of the company I work for. We're a very new company, and we're building a $2 billion project in a very short space of time. And we had a management group of 10. And we recognized very quickly, or the owner companies, that we didn't have enough people in our management group. So they hired a vice president of research, and they didn't consult the management group of 10. And that created quite a stir in the company. They decided they needed two more vice presidents. So we had an organization development type come in. And we spent hours and hours and hours trying to decide what sort of organizational structure we should have. And then they hired the two men that they wanted anyway. And, you know, made the structure just what the owner companies wanted. And I was wondering if all this participation in looking and preparing these 20 documents isn't just the same sort of defusing exercise.
It's kind of window dressing.
It's defusing. It gives everybody a feeling that they're participating when they're not.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know how much of what they did got into the final documents, and what were those documents?
It's how real is this process?
Yeah.
Very difficult to know. In theory,
we flagellate ourselves about, you know, our democratic form of government.
That's
when I think of Dostoevsky, the Russians, freedom, you know, those guys had a ball because they didn't know what it was. And then, so they did all this theorizing about, how do you handle this thing that we know nothing about? Whereas freedom, in the political sense, has been a growing thing in Western civilization. I think of, say, British. Particularly concepts of freedom, which has evolved very gradually, which we've been taught to prize, our political form of government, checks and balances.
Actually,
the
it's
parliamentary
been,
system,
been
the,
a growing thing, but it's also been it's had its kind of growth, and now we see actually a growth in another direction. As you could interpret the last 200 or 300 years as the history of an attempt to overcome the mistakes and the inability of freedom and democracy to function. That is, both communism and fascism in the West can be said to be attempts to deal with the inadequacy of democratic institutions. And then, as you see the development around the rest of the world, there's almost no place in the rest. If you just take history now, and you're looking at it from developmental concept, I'm not trying to make a value judgment, I'm just trying to take a historic view. You could say that almost everywhere in the world, there is a movement away from the democratic conceptions toward a focus on a centralization and a determination of policy in terms of some plan is over against much more self-initiation. When we have to agree, the that's what's happening developmentally.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that the democratic system has the seeds of its own destruction in it. So I think it worked as long as you had a sort of limited electorate. And a very well-informed electorate. But we've got mass media now. We've got organizations that can take certain segments of society. And I heard someone talking yesterday about having a university in their city, so that the university now can control whatever that city does. Sorts of things that have happened that we never thought would have happened.
Nancy. Louder.
Oh. We can't hear you.
It's more conceptual than practical along the lines of what you've been saying, but it's important with regard to when you mentioned vision. I think that the relationship between freedom and vision, and vision logically moving to hope, is one way to bring together this idea of Christian freedom to being bound to God. And just as these kind of freedom, the types you mentioned, I think Dostoevsky's character, especially in Crime and Punishment, definitely had vision and hope, you know, along with the destructive kind of freedom. But, and two, then, within our political processes, you know, how do we define our own freedom? I think I would define it by way of vision. And at least in our American society, what I've seen is I don't think we have it. Or do we? That's my question, you know. If we define our freedom by our vision or our hope,
I think what happens, at least through Dostoevsky, in terms of what you're saying, is that we get so caught up in the idea of just having freedom, just initiating, just having, you know, just choosing, and you just may choose to do whatever you want to do. And I think that's more of what many times is the concept of freedom is thought of. I just will do what I want to do, and so often, without a vision, or without an idea of what the good is, then, and I think that's the American idea of freedom, basically. I'll do what I want to do and nobody's going to bother me as long as I don't step on 20 toes. Well, you might step on 20 toes, particularly if you go through the process of moving ahead, you might say.
Isn't part of Dostoevsky's effort to show the destructiveness of this kind of license, just unlimited freedom? I've learned that from you. I'm just repeating what you told me.
Yeah.
But is that ever possible? I mean, you know, we're bound by our personal history. We're bound by our, you know, economic limitations. And I see, you know, the whole concept of freedom severely cramped. And I'm still not sure that the people ever got a hold of the Vietnam situation. I think that was a nice, cool political move at that time. And Nixon could have buried us over. We could have been over there for another 10 years. And I'm not so sure, you know, if 60 million people were uptight about it would have made any difference.
Now, you're back on not question of theory that Nancy was raising, but the question of fact.
Yeah, I mean, you know, assuming there is freedom, how do we act that out? And, you know, what limits that? I just you know, happen to see an awful lot of limitations.
Well, information certainly limits what you can do and how you can be responsible. If you don't know what's happening, as the control of information was one of the problems in Vietnam. I think it's one of the problems in the nuclear energy battle, is that we simply haven't known what's going on, what decisions are made. And the AC actually has concealed all the accidents from 62 on there. You just don't know what has happened. And there's no way to make up your mind whether they're dangerous or not, because you don't even know, you know, what has happened to the nuclear reactors since 62. They gave us the information before.
Are you talking about a couple kinds of freedom? I don't mean the three that you were talking about, Al, but there seems to be like an individual freedom and a kind of a corporate or social freedom. I mean, I may be perfectly free not to care how many people die in nuclear reaction accidents and that kind of thing. If I am perfectly free to do whatever I want, then I think corporate freedom is always going to be in, I'm going to be in complete conflict with that. I mean, they can't tolerate me. And yet, a social freedom may have a tremendous vision. It's like, when I think of guys like Solzhenitsyn, or guys like Michelangelo, those guys, you're dealing with individuals who are almost antithetical. They are doing what they are doing, and you say, my gosh, to be free like those guys, but they're doing it in spite of the kind of, if you want to call it social, conformity of thought. I think it's really kind of neat, the relationship that the most creative periods in history have had to the most tyrannical.
And you mean that the most creative artists have occurred in the most tyrannical social situations?
It's scary, but I think you got a case.
Jack.
See what comes out of Missouri Senate now, Rich. I tell you, some very creative things have already happened. Sarah, one of the points I was going to think about when talking about this being practical and theoretical, and Al mentioned Mao, what's happening in Mao's China, and as opposed to maybe what we know as freedom, what we think of as freedom, and how they differ. And tying that in with Dostoevsky, it made me think of, in my opinion, the best writing in Crime and Punishment, for example, is when the Stalinov talking to the prosecutor,
Sonia.
How one-on-one is very compassionate, almost, as Rip said, almost antithetical to the theoretical problems going on in his mind about whether or not to what a man should need to do to survive, and he should kill the moneylender because he thinks he can do better things for the world if he just had her money. And in Brothers, when the young priest is talking to the boy who's dying in the bed, that's the tenderest part, the best writing, I think, in the whole novel. There again, it's one-on-one, almost antithetical to the great theoretical problems going on in Brothers. I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but it seems to me that there's a tension between, as Rich pointed out, the artist or the individual's freedom, one-on-one, compassion, sympathy, as in the great milieu of ideas. Maybe it doesn't matter what the society does, as long as people are accepted.
Well, that's one of the issues, I think, in terms of if we think of, in at least in my stereotype of what I think China might be, is where does that individual come in? Again, as I, imagine, and imagination is different from another thing, but as individuals, oftentimes individuals are not compassionate to other individuals either. They kill them, oftentimes. And there are atrocities with one-on-one, too. I mean, the dialectic is just amazing in terms of, what happens with that word and concept of freedom. The destructiveness, the dignity of it, the whole idea of how can society be shaped if you have free will? Because if everyone in here has free will, we may go that many directions and never be able to even come on a one-on-one basis. Or we also have we can relate compassionately, lovingly, sensitively. What do we say in our schools now? We want to relate one-on-one, right? To get that individual attention. But how do we expand it? The Grand Inquisitor says you can't. I mean, you either got to have harmony or you got to have freedom, and the two don't meet. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, if you took Rich's principle, then what Carol was saying, I think Carol was thinking, and Paul, particularly Paul Haynes, was saying that in China you won't get much creative art. So in Mao's speeches and in the practice, the artists have to go down and live in the communities, and they are required somehow to rub shoulders with all kinds of people on the theory that somehow the art is going to express something other than a subjectivism, that's Mao's word, than the personal. It's going to be somehow an expression of the life And he, over and over again, is going to express the life of the masses, of the people. He's going to come out of that. And therefore, they are required, and they are required to have certain kinds of experiences. Over again, somebody going off like, you know, on his own and doing his own thing. So that it's a different situation.
I don't know.
But what we have, I think.
Did anyone see the film on public broadcasting that Shirley MacLaine's group did? Anyone see that? Is it only in Chicago? Well, anyway, Shirley MacLaine took a group of women to China. She also wrote a book called You Can't Get There From Here. Right? And it was interesting, one, to have a cross-section of the American women going to China, from a 12-year-old to an Indian woman, to a Puerto Rican woman, to a black woman, all sorts of political affiliations and all kinds of types. They went to China and with a female film crew, too, and they filmed quite a bit, and they put a portion of it on PBS. You may be able to see it sometime. And both in the film and in the book, of course, Shirley MacLaine is an artist, had terrible problems with the idea of the creative artist and what happens in China. And of course, and she would ask over and over, and this was in the film, you know, what happens if you have a Michelangelo? You know, and the sort of common response she got was, well, we would educate him to be a part of the community. And that really bothered it. It really bothers me. Really bothers a lot of people. You know, boy, I don't think I can handle that. And she kept saying, I don't think I can handle that. She said she went through this time and really reflected, you know, as an artist, you know, what would she do? And she came home, she reflected on it more, and what she finally sort of resolved in her mind was that the art that she would create, or that was created at least, was in context of the community. And that it was not only just for the community, but in working for community, you worked for yourself. I mean, you created for yourself. And she still has problems. It's not, you know, she didn't all of a sudden resolve it or anything, but she tried to figure out in her mind, if we really had a vision that included more than myself, and if I created art just because I liked a piece of, I like to dance or I like to act or whatever, without any regard of broader context, what happens? And that happens oftentimes here. But, you know, she still had problems with the idea of the art in context.
Yeah, I always say, what price freedom? If we have to go through what some of the destructive consequences in our big cities and so forth, in order to have a few artists, I wonder. I mean, you got that question. What price for you?
Rich and then Roxy and then Barb.
No deal.
Oh, and then David.
Oh. Well, I guess I wouldn't be concerned that all that much about what you would do if you got a Michelangelo. You wouldn't get one. And that may be all right. I mean, that's, I don't know, general consent may establish what freedom actually is in a certain place. But the first thing Hitler established in his regime was an elementary education system which was very one-on-one, and which didn't allow for a person to shoot off into tangents. So, you know, that particular problem, I don't think
would happen? You don't think that, you think only in a very individualistic or tyrannical society can you have the creativity?
Well, I don't, you know, that
it wouldn't be allowed.
The first thing about vision.
Yeah.
You're not talking about creativity in that sense. Studies of art would identify that in time, it's an anomaly to have a kind of freedom in art or in creativity, or put the premium on it that we do now in the 20th century. It's a total anomaly. The history of art would reveal that your comments about the kinds of art visioned in Mao's China is more normal than it has I'm dreaming up the figure, but it might be 80% of all of man's time, art has functioned that way. So what we're really discussing is not the creativity or value, but function. What is the art's purpose? What is man's purpose? We ought to get back to that maybe. Yeah, I think this is more important to talk about what is man's purpose and function.
Art might express, and I think that's what's crucial for me, is the content of art, what it expresses. Not simply that it's created in the sense it has a form. It's the meaning of it. And I may do a disservice to art.
I was thinking in some of the past experiences I've had just recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, that my interpretation of freedom has to do with what can I do if I care? And people will say to me, you can't fight City Hall. And oh yes, you can. You know, if you care enough, if you go and you fight and beat it out, and I'm not sure that you can all the time, because I'm a woman, and boy, I'm telling you, I'm very aware of it in the political system. And, you know, so if for instance, I were a black woman, I'm not sure I could do anything at all. But sometimes I have to say to my husband, pardon me, I want to inform you about a few things, and I give him a big long list of things. I need your body. Would you come down and tell this to so-and-so at the county city building? But he comes down and tells it to so-and-so. So-and-so suddenly, oh yes, that's a really neat feeling. It came out of a man's body. And, I mean, that's great. I like men's bodies, and I like women's bodies, but I think it's hilarious that 99% of the people that I've worked with on that level are all men. And when you work in the Corps of Engineers, I only met one woman who had any kind of position in the Army Corps of Engineers. So
I was going to ask if the other people in Shirley MacLaine's group had many fewer problems not being all artists in dealing with China.
Well, they had various problems, but you got it from her perspective because she did the. Well, I mean, they had various problems with
the members of maybe more
the individual,
more tightly knit groups, say the Puerto Rican women, the Indian women. Did they see a lot more positive sides? Did they see a lot more positive things coming out of China than they did Shirley MacLaine?
Shirley MacLaine saw a lot of positive things in China.
She was very.
I would say that there was a mixture in all of the women in the group. I mean, it obviously it's not an either or thing. I mean, you're kind of being pulled.
So I remember the comments, the most negative was from the conservative church woman who really had a problem with the lack of the symbol system, of the Christian symbol system. And it's the same question that Walt raised the other night as to whether the spirit is present if the symbol, sacramental system, is it possible that the spirit of Christianity can be present in a society if you don't have the symbol system? And I think frequently that's the crucial issue in our thinking about what's happening in other nations, as to whether you can affirm something and see it as positive if the symbol system is denied. That is, if the Christian symbols are denied even a hearing. And I think people tend to agree that they are not getting a hearing in China, and it doesn't look like them. As a matter of fact, one interpreter said that Mao's got to fight Christianity because it's so close to what he's about. And if it were given a chance, it would divide the country, which he wants to keep unified in terms of the overall functioning. That is, it is so much in tune with what is happening in terms of brotherhood and concern for all and care for the needy and care for those who are most in trouble and admission of guilt and admission of being in error. You just go through all those things are coming out all the time, and by the time you get through that substance, you say, well, man, that sounds like what we think about in theory. You know, the capacity to change and to work with other people and to listen, that is so emphasized. To listen to other people.
I was just going to ask, did this lady miss symbols or Christian symbols? Because it seems to me
Christian
that they're on slogans. And
they have their own symbol system.
Their own
system. Right.
Very strong.
No system will function, I think, without a symbol system. But it's a Christian symbol.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
And the possibility for them, you see.
I think too that there might be an element of when you want freedom, there is a thing that you need to do that you have to be free in order to achieve. And thus I think maybe freedom is somehow connected with a kind of success. To fight City Hall, there's something wrong there, you want to straighten it out. And I think there might also be a kind of freedom which is hooked up kind of nicely with failure. I mean, you know, free to really to really screw up, to really fail. I think of C.S. Lewis on his Reflections in the Psalms talking about Akhenaten, the Pharaoh, who was really he doesn't make any sense in the whole dynastic system of Egypt, and here was a guy who conceived of one God. I mean, he believes, he acknowledges it. He probably tears up the whole system of the priests and everything. They've now got to acknowledge one God. It was such a disaster. It split Egypt, and Egypt almost collapsed under this one God idea of Akhenaten. And he failed. But some people kind of acknowledge that Moses was the one that inherited the learning.
Every time we use the word freedom, I wonder what we mean by it. Yeah. And I wondered what you did. And I guess there's only one thing I want to leave with you, is that freedom in the history of thought is a very complex term. And in what I call a Platonic Christian tradition, freedom is always being bound to the true and the good by choice. So you combine two notions, maybe three, but at least two that are obvious. That is, it's choice, it's your initiation, and you choose voluntarily to obey the demands of the good and the true.
Is that your good and your truth?
No, it's not. It is mine too, but it's a truth and a goodness that has a universal quality. See, it assumes that there is a truth and a goodness for the whole. It assumes God. It really, in our language, it assumes God, and that you're only free when you choose to obey God. When you choose. Now, that's got all kinds of problems in terms of the vision of God and what the content is, but that's the formal character. And that's, I just like to say that that really requires us to rethink our notion of freedom, which is heavily weighted on the side simply of choice. Simply of choice.
In the discussion today, it seems that the assumption was that City Hall was always something that you needed to fight against. Aren't there some City Halls that one doesn't have to fight?
Of course.
In principle.
If you work it.
I think that from some notions of freedom, any other determination would be negative. So all city halls tend to regulate, and that's negative. So you want them the least possible, and so you really are always fighting the extension of their action. If you took the American notion of self-initiation as dominant, then you want the least regulation. Government is only to establish the conditions so you don't kill each other off. And therefore, any regulation by government would be negative. But you have to have some, but you have the minimum amount. So in that sense, from that point of view, what I'm trying to say is there are different interpretations. From that interpretation, City Hall always would be, you would always be fighting its extension of its interests and of its domination, of its determination of your life. You would want just the minimal. In that sense, you wouldn't be trying to get it to do very much. You'd only be trying to get it to do those things which simply have to be done and limit it, keep it from doing all the other things it tends to want to do.
Well, I don't mean to leave on a negative note, but the Grand Inquisitor, if he was sitting right here talking to Christ somewhere, he'd say, "Dost thou forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom? to freedom of choice in the knowledge of good and evil. Nothing is more seductive for man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing is a greater cause of suffering. Nothing is a greater cause of suffering. And he felt, the Grand Inquisitor, his world, man should not suffer. And Christ has given too much of a burden of freedom, and most of us don't want it. And we give it to somebody else because we can't handle it.
Okay, I think we should disband. There's another program, I think, here. I hope that we've opened up some of these things. I think it's a terribly important thing to get straight on, or get an idea about where you are.